Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in this hour, after 40 years of the Lexington Herald Leader as a reporter's reporter, Bill Estep, who has covered many of the major Kentucky stories of our time, recently announced his retirement. And education in a world increasingly influenced by artificial intelligence. First, according to Stat News, a tracking database shows that more than 2,600 National Institute of Health grants, totaling about $9 billion, have been canceled since President Donald Trump took office in January. Beyond the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that was just recently passed by Congress and signed into law by the president, a separate and critical process is now underway, and that's the development of the actual fiscal year 2026 spending bills, the budget. The House and Senate Appropriations Committees are currently working on funding plans for all federal agencies, including the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Awaiting the outcome of that is very much on the mind of Tori Votaw. She's a Ph.D. from Georgetown, Kentucky, a graduate of Scott County High and the University of Kentucky. Today, she is an addiction psychologist at McLean Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Her work focuses on personalizing treatments for substance use and addiction. And recently, she's been very concerned about cuts in federal funding for health research, concerned enough to write about it in an op-ed that appeared recently in the Lexington Herald Leader. Dr. Votaw joins us from Belmont, Massachusetts. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks so much, Tom. Really excited to talk with you today.
Tori, some brief background, if we could, about your journey from Georgetown to Harvard Medical School, and what attracted you to the work of figuring out why and how people become addicted?
I was in high school and college at the University of Kentucky when the opioid epidemic was really becoming more and more visible. This was around 2010 to 2015, where people were increasingly transitioning from prescription opioids to heroin use. And that was really causing increasingly devastating consequences in people's lives. So this was receiving more media attention. And in this context, I saw friends and classmates who used opioids and other drugs. And I personally saw some of these devastating consequences, which really stuck with me. But I think I was also really fascinated by the individual differences in the development of and recovery from addiction. So some of the people that I knew would experiment with opioids and other drugs, and then they just kind of aged out. They stopped using at some point, whereas others went on to develop severe addiction. And then I also knew people who would seek treatment for substance use or who would try to stop using substances. And some recovered really quickly, sometimes even without formal treatment, whereas others struggled for years and years despite multiple treatment episodes. And even when they were, you know, sober or not using, they never really felt like themselves anymore. And I just became fascinated with these individual differences in substance use trajectories. And I wanted to better understand what influences people to go on to develop addiction and to recover from it, and how to use that knowledge to reduce suffering. And these personal experiences and observations really motivated me to study psychology at the University of Kentucky. Initially, I wanted to be a therapist, but I was fortunate to be exposed to research early on in my undergraduate education. And I realized I could use science to investigate these questions and to ultimately try to reduce human suffering on a large scale.
Well, let's fast forward to this moment today. And if you would, tell us a little bit about the work that you're now engaged in at Harvard.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I'll start with my broad program of research, as I call it, is really focused on personalizing addiction treatment, which is figuring out how to match people with the treatments that are most likely to work for them. And I'll just give a little bit of background on why that's important. We have a range of effective treatments for substance use disorders. So we have several different FDA-approved medications, specifically for alcohol use disorder and opioid use disorder. And we also have a range of different psychotherapies. And these treatments work, but they don't work for everyone. So my work is really focused on increasing the odds that each person gets the care that fits them best. When they go into a treatment setting, they are going to get a treatment that hopefully works for them well and relatively quickly. So I'll give an example of one type of project like this that I'm working on. And this project is focused on buprenorphine treatment for opioid addiction. buprenorphine is a really effective medication for opioid addiction, with the caveat that it's really effective when people are in treatment. But we know that about half of people relapse and leave treatment early, so they're not getting the benefits from these medications. So one of the projects I'm working on is studying how we can predict early, within the first week or two of treatment, who's likely to struggle with buprenorphine treatment, who's likely to ultimately relapse and leave treatment, so we can identify those people while they're still engaged and we can offer them extra support or even transition them to a different type of treatment that might work better for them.
Let's talk about what brought you to the pages of the Lexington Herald Leader, which connects directly with what you just told us. And that is the threat of a loss of funding to continue that kind of really important research. And I know that you have personal experience with funding from the National Institutes of Health. Tell us about that first, if you would.
I think I can honestly say that I would not be where I am today without NIH support. My training has almost entirely been funded by labs that are supported by the NIH. And I'll just give some examples of this type of research that I've been working on, NIH-funded projects across my education and training. So when I was an undergraduate student at the University of Kentucky, I was actually really fortunate to work in three NIH-funded labs that focused on substance use. For example, one of these labs that I worked in tested medications for opioid addiction, but this lab also studied what we call the abuse liability of prescription opioids. So this was at a time when prescription opioids were increasingly being marketed as abuse deterrent. And in this lab, we would actually test that. Like, how likely are people to misuse the opioids that are being marketed as less likely to be abused? And then in graduate school, I went to graduate school at the University of New Mexico, and I worked on NIH-funded studies developing mindfulness treatments for addiction, and also studies that broadened how we define recovery from alcohol use disorder. But most important to me, my dissertation, which is the big project you have to complete to get a PhD, was NIH-funded. And this project focused on which patients are likely to benefit from different alcohol treatments. We found that those who primarily drink to socialize or to have fun do better with different medications and treatments than those who primarily drink to cope with negative emotions. And that dissertation and training was NIH funded. And lastly, here at McLean and Harvard, I'm really focused on submitting an NIH-funded career development award. So as somebody who's in a role who is entirely grant-funded, I depend on career development awards by the NIH to build my own independent program of research in my own lab.
The analysts at the Brookings Institution have put the proposed 2026 budget under the microscope and analyzed it. And the budget for the next fiscal year that Congress is now working on, as I mentioned, proposes an overall 40% cut in funding for the National Institutes of Health. The newly formed National Institute on Behavioral Health, which merges the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, would have 44% less funding for research grants, 30% less for research centers, 43% lower spending on other research, and a 14% cut in intramural research from these component institutes. If these cuts are passed and signed into law, what will that mean to research and ultimately to people?
It's hard to know where to even start with this question because the scale of these cuts are so large. And I guess I want to hit on three points if I can. On the research side, it means that fewer studies will be funded. And that's not just a loss of, you know, ideas, but this is the loss of potential treatments and cures that we might never know about. They might never come to light. We don't even know what we're losing here, to be honest. And I think a really powerful statistic that shows this is that over 99% of all new drugs that were approved from 2010 to 2019 had some NIH-funded research behind them. And these cuts could really slow that pipeline. So I am really concerned about the treatments that we're going to lose, especially advances in addiction research. I really also worry deeply about the future of science as a career. The NIH funds graduate students to go to graduate school and early career scientists like myself to build an independent lab. And I think we're both going to see fewer people entering science as a career if these cuts are in place, as well as more people leaving science as a career. So that's going to compound, you know, our loss of knowledge that could also be the case from less research funding. And I do also want to hit on, too, that these would also have really big impacts on the economy. There's been recent reports that state that every $1 that NIH gives to a community generates about $2.46 in economic activity. In 2023, Kentucky received $234 million from the NIH, which supported 3,000 jobs and over $600 million in economic activity. So that's just so many jobs, so much you know, really infrastructure that supports communities, that supports education for our young people, that cannot be overstated.
Well, what could these cuts mean for the training and career development of people from rural backgrounds who aspire to careers in science and who are critically needed in those fields?
It's a really important question, and honestly, one that I don't think has been getting as much coverage. One thing to know is that the NIH used to fund training and career development grants that were specifically aimed at diversifying the scientific workforce. And these training and career development grants supported graduate students and early career scientists from underrepresented backgrounds. And what many people don't realize is that growing up in a rural community qualifies as being underrepresented in science. And these grants used to support folks like that. So it would support their research as well as their mentorship, career development, and their training. And people from rural backgrounds are so critical to have in science because these are the people who tend to be really passionate about rural healthcare and who tend to have really innovative ideas about how to improve healthcare in rural areas. They understand the needs and challenges of their communities in ways that others may not. So I think it's really devastating that the NIH has already terminated so many of these grant mechanisms and they've canceled future grants under these mechanisms. So we really risk losing these voices from science.
Eliminating anything that has to do with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is government-wide under this administration. How would this affect diversity grants funding research and improving rural healthcare?
Beyond the impacts to training that we just talked about, I think it's important to note that the proposed budget that you've referenced previously completely eliminates the National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. And this institute funds much of the research on rural health disparities. So you can actually do a search for studies that this institute currently funds on a website called NIH Reporter. And if you do that, you'll see a lot of work that's focused on reducing smoking in rural communities, improving the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, and improving the quality of healthcare for children with disabilities. And it's really hard to know, you know, what eliminating this institute, what the impact would be on this type of work, or to imagine that the elimination of this institute wouldn't end a lot of this important research. So I think I'm very concerned about what eliminating this institute might do to research focused on rural health disparities.
In the op-ed, you write that as a response to these proposed funding cuts, you have cycled through a lot of emotions, shock, outrage, fear, helplessness, determination, and hope. And you keep coming back to your Kentucky roots in the process of that. What brings you full circle back to Kentucky?
I guess I'll start with some of my initial reactions to these attacks on the NIH. So when these were first coming out, you know, in late January, February, I really went to the media to see, like, how are people talking about this? Is this getting out there? Is this, you know, like, reaching the public? Do people know about this? And as I was looking for these answers, I found that most of the media coverage really focused on the impacts of these cuts on elite institutions like Harvard, Columbia, Johns Hopkins. And there were a lot of narratives that these cuts will largely hurt elite institutions. And that's certainly the case. I think, you know, living in the Boston area, it's certainly the case that people affiliated with Harvard are suffering right now. But as somebody who was trained entirely in public schools at the University of Kentucky and the University of New Mexico, I've been able to see how important NIH funding is to places like Kentucky and New Mexico. And I really like reflected on my entire journey, the fact that I was really able to discover this career through NIH-funded labs at the University of Kentucky, and how students like me might not be able to have that experience if these cuts are put into place. And I also thought about all of the people that I, you know, worked with in Kentucky who are suffering from addiction or who I knew, and how we really need to do better for them to make sure we reduce the suffering associated with addiction.
As Dr. Tori Votaw, a Scott County Kentuckian who's now an addiction psychologist at McLean Hospital and Harvard Medical School, speaking with us from Belmont, Massachusetts. Thank you, Tori.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, AI in education and what we can learn from how they're doing it in Anaheim, California. And as he retires, veteran Herald leader Eastern Kentucky reporter Bill Estep looks to the future of journalism. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. In her day job as president and CEO of the Lexington-based Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, our education series host, Bridget Blom, recently visited the Anaheim, California school district, and while she was there, Bridget heard something that she wanted to bring back to us here in Kentucky, that gone are the days when getting a high school diploma alone is enough to give a young person a shot at having some success in life, that high school graduates today need an entirely new set of skills to navigate a digital, social media-informed, AI-influenced world, and that educators, community leaders, and state policymakers need to make sure that a meaningful high school diploma does just that.
Michael Matsuda is a nationally recognized educational leader known for innovation, entrepreneurship, and compassion. Under his leadership, the Anaheim Union High School District has built a new educational model called the Career Preparedness Systems Framework. In partnership with higher education, private, and nonprofit sectors, this model has transformed educational opportunities for all students, centering on their own voice and sense of purpose. Mr. Matsuda is also the co-author, alongside David Brazer, of Educating for a Purposeful Life, which serves as a blueprint for the school district's transformation in Anaheim. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Michael.
Well, it's great to be here, Bridget.
So my first question for you, diving into your work and sparing no minutes, the Anaheim Collaborative, formed under your leadership, is a pioneering partnership that includes Cypress College, Fullerton College, Cal State Fullerton, the University of California at Irvine, your feeder elementary districts, and the city of Anaheim. So you're tracking your students years down the line to see how they are faring. Michael, can you talk to us about the importance of partnerships in ensuring students succeed well beyond high school and what results you've seen from this unique approach?
Yes, thank you for the question. First of all, we now have longitudinal data that's up 4 years of tracking our students beyond high school. And I think that's really an important piece, to have data sharing agreements with higher education so you can do just that. And our low-income, primarily Hispanic kids have outperformed the higher-income kids as they matriculate into the University of California, Irvine, and at Cal State University, Fullerton, both in grades and in completion rates. So those are huge data points. And coupled with the fact that we do not teach to the test in our district, our kids still take the federally required tests, but no one talks about test scores in our district. They talk about the skills that students need to succeed both in college and in careers. And those skills are the skills coveted by the world of work. 80% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch.
Much of that is a result of the partnerships that you've been able to bring together around the Anaheim School District. So share with us what those partnerships look like.
Well, they're both in the higher ed arena, those set of partners, but importantly in the business and nonprofit arenas. So I think the challenge for school leaders is to develop the ability to have the language to speak to business leaders and vice versa. It's a whole different culture. The business world is a whole different culture. And there's different mental models, too, that school leaders have about business leaders and vice versa. So you have to be very intentional about building the structures. We call it the Anaheim Collaborative. And with the business community, it's primarily through the Anaheim Innovative Mentorship Program, AIM for short, in which the businesses bring in mentors to our students, and we have thousands of them now. And that's been very, very important in terms of widening a young person's aperture of what the world of work looks like. I think our job as educators has been focused on helping that child understand his or her own purpose in life. That purpose then leads to a career or a major. And that's one reason why the University of California feels our students are outperforming, because they are persistent. They know their why.
And having visited with you in Anaheim, they go through a process that you refer to as a capstone, not project, but a capstone program. One of the things that struck me in my visit is that the students are tapping into existing needs in the community, responses from the community about needs and problems. And as part of their capstone project, over quite a few years, they're wrestling with those problems and identifying solutions, and maybe through that experience, identifying a sense of purpose that they take beyond high school.
That's right. So we believe in transforming schools through interactions in the classrooms, right? Yes, we love after-school programs or Saturday programs, but the real interactions between the teacher and the students are where it happens. And I think that opening the classrooms to challenges in the local communities, like access to housing or homelessness or food insecurity or what's going on in the local environment. These are issues that students are interested in, and we've allowed teachers through their content standards to design project-based learning experiences for students to tackle these problems, reflect on them, and develop their sense of purpose and belonging, and helping to move the needle of solving local problems. And then what we've done is we brought in entrepreneurship as well. So we want kids not only to help solve problems, but learn how to monetize them and eventually create patents and businesses and create their own futures, which I think across America, we need to do more of.
So the learning becomes really relevant for them in a way they can see and feel in their local community and to each of them as individuals as they think about a future with AI, a future that is maybe much more global. As they're thinking ahead to what's on the horizon, they're having experiences that position them. Michael, you mentioned the world of work with durable skills also that set them up for the future.
Correct. And I do want to say this about AI, because everybody's talking about it. What they're not talking about is this tectonic shift in the job market, right? We've got a lot of attention about the Tesla robo taxi and all of that. But if you start looking under the hood of college graduates, there's 25% underemployment right now with college graduates. And a lot of it is because AI is taking those entry-level jobs. So this is a real national dilemma, in that we need to get these powerful AI tools into the hands of teachers so we can get students to understand how to use these tools so that they can be better positioned to get these high-paying jobs. So it's a full frontal assault that AI is doing to us in education, and I don't think many of us are ready for that. At the same time, we're charged with protecting student privacy and all of that, but this is what we're grappling with in Anaheim, and we're seeing some real movement in Kentucky as well. So that's great to know.
So you're building into student support system, maybe even a teacher support system in Anaheim through a partnership with eCadence. You're building AI into tools that support student progression, teacher development of lesson plans. Share with us what that looks like and how AI is incorporated seamlessly so that students and teachers maybe experience AI in a way that is non-threatening.
So if you think about the issues of community problems and surveys and stuff like that, not just from students, from parents, to identify what are some of the big challenges in a local community, that information can go into eCadence and accessed by the teachers to create amazing lesson plans around those problems and allowing students opportunities to choose and solve the problems. And again, this is aligned through the content standards. And this is where the teachers love to be tapped for their own innovation and creativity. Once a student is done with that project, and it could be a 3 to 5 day project, or it could be a group project, we build reflection into that. Because if you think about that, that's where true learning happens. We call it transcendent thinking and learning. That's kind of the aha moment where the kid says, I get why math or, you know, geometry is so important, because I'm applying it to a real problem. Those types of transcendent learning is where we need to go with education. And then that's all put into the AI. The AI then helps the kid understand their strengths and weaknesses based on these transferable skills, as well as feedback to the teacher, so the teacher can build better lesson plans in the future. And so now we're finally having teachers and students work together on building sort of a customized lessons using AI as a sort of a co-pilot in developing these things. So that's just one example, but we're also moving with parents. So parents can now access in real time how their child is doing, and then with AI help can help them actually address their kid in terms of how they might get better at something. Because the AI knows what the kid's interests are, their sports, their coaches, and they can really help the parent navigate the world of school as well. So we're using AI not to replace teachers, but to enhance the interaction between teachers and students, and so we can all get better.
Michael, you reference Raj Chetty's research on innovation ecosystems and the transformative impact they can have for underrepresented students. What does building an innovation ecosystem look like in a district with limited resources like Anaheim, where you have 80% free and reduced price lunch? And also, where should communities start?
Yeah, okay, two things. Like, Raj Chetty has done amazing work looking at census data, and he tied the social economic status to creation and innovation in this country. And what he has said is that if we can build innovative ecosystems and regions, we can actually quadruple the number of patents in America. And it's a shame that America, which has been the bastion of creativity and innovation in the world in the 20th and 21st century, we need to tap into that talent that's right in front of us through the kids. And in order to do that, we have to unleash the talent of teachers. So to build that goes back to that first question, Bridget, is how do we build a collaborative with business and higher ed? And building it in an intentional way that we can also expose students to innovation in the classroom using advanced AI tools to problem solve and also learn to monetize as they create solutions to our local problems. I think every business community, whether it's Kentucky or in California, they want the talent that's developed to stay local. The local talent are the deep roots of our society. And now we see too many kids leaving, and we want to keep them in Kentucky. We want to keep them in California. And the way we do that is to build an intentional ecosystem with the partners of business and higher ed as well, in a very transparent way, that we can share data, we can be vulnerable with that data, so we can get better together.
So, Michael, you're clearly passionate about a number of things in the education space and what sets us up for the future. I have found you most passionate about what is at the center of all of this, and that is our students, our young people. So tell us what makes you hopeful for the future for our young people.
Well, I think it's the kids themselves, right? They have a lot of energy. They have a lot of imagination. They do want to solve these tremendous problems. They are aware that their generation has a lot of challenges in front of them. But I would also say they are the most loving and compassionate generation that I've seen in my all my 67 years of life. And since the 1960s, right, this generation has a lot of potential to help propel this country forward. And it gives me great hope when I interact with kids and see their capstones and their transcendent thinking. And I think there's great hope for America as we together, as we embrace them. And as the Pritchard Committee is doing in Kentucky, so do we with our Anaheim Collaborative in California.
Mr. Michael Matsuda, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Sometimes things that have shaped our lives in very meaningful ways can quietly disappear from the day to day. Take Bill Estep, for example. Bill's decades of tireless professional journalism for the Lexington Herald-Leader have provided a detailed record of life in Kentucky, his home region of eastern Kentucky in particular. June 30th was Bill's last day at the Herald-Leader after reporting the biggest stories in the Commonwealth for 40 years and in possession of a deep wealth of knowledge and perspective, Bill has retired. Bill Estep, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So, retired on June 30th after 40 years with the Lexington Herald-Leader, you have covered so much. I mean, I've been reading you for as long as I can remember, so there's a lot to talk about here. Let's begin, though, with those really early days. What do you recall about them? What maybe your first assignment?
Well, I actually started, my first job was at a weekly newspaper in Harlan County called the Tri-City News. It's located in Cumberland, and it's Cumberland, Benham, and Lynch are three small towns there in near Black Mountain in Harlan County. So the first story I did there, I still remember, I saved a copy of the paper. There'd been a trial there a couple of years earlier where the sheriff had been accused of conspiring, plotting to kill two of his political enemies. And he was convicted and went to prison, but was appealing, and the prosecutor was claiming that someone had bribed one of the witnesses. So the first story I did was about alleged political corruption in Harlan County. And after I left there, then I worked there for several months. Then I went to the newspaper in Somerset, in the Commonwealth Journal, which is where I grew up. And then I started at the Herald-Leader in August of 1985. And the first story I did there was an interview with David Williams, who was then a state House member, a Republican from Cumberland County. He believed that because he had voted against Martha Lane Collins's education package, he'd been cut out for his district had lost some funding for a project. So that was my first, more political intrigue was my first story at the Herald Leader.
Wow. You really hit the ground running. And so let's reel back to that first story. How old were you when you took that one on?
I was just out of college. I finished college. I went to Western in Bowling Green, finished in December of 82. So I was hired a couple months later at the Tri-City News. It was owned at that time by the Gish family, Tom and Pat Gish, who owned the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg. And they had also bought the paper Across the Mountain in Cumberland. So I would have been 23 at that time.
Wow. Okay, so let's fast forward to that David Williams story. David Williams, if you can't recall, he went on to become the Senate president in the state legislature, and a very powerful one at that.
Did you
follow his career all the way up to that point?
Oh, I did, yeah. I mean, and he is now a circuit judge in Cumberland County, and there's a couple other counties in that circuit. But my career for a while kind of paralleled Senator Williams's, I guess. He moved from the House to the Senate. And then in 1995, I covered the Paul Patton, Larry Forgy governor's race. And after, you know, Paul Patton won that by one of the narrowest margins in state history. And so then I moved to our Frankfort office to run the office there during the first Patton term and was there through that and part of his second term. So, and that was during the time when Senator Williams obviously became Senate president too. So I started out at the Herald Leader in a regional office and then moved to Frankfort and I've done some special projects and then went back to the Somerset office in 2002, a regional office.
And Somerset was home, is that right?
That's right. I grew up there,
uh-huh.
Yes.
And a really great tribute to you, Bill. Your former colleague, Linda Blackford, at the Herald Leader, wrote that you have, as she put it, profiled coal miners, pot farmers, and snake handlers, exposed corrupt politicians, pill pushers, and pedophiles, zigzagged the state to describe harrowing floods and tornadoes, and changed Kentucky policy through investigative reporting. So I'd like to talk about that last thing with you, Bill, investigative reporting, which sounds to me now like you hit the ground running in that corner of the field. But how is an investigative reporter distinguished from a general assignment reporter?
We generally consider investigative reporting something that's more involved, takes longer, more in-depth. But I also have always believed that every reporter is an investigative reporter because every time you set out to do a story, you're investigating something. It may not be controversial. It may be investigating what the city council is doing or and what the school board is doing or what the water company is doing. But you're always looking into something, digging into something, investigating something. So I believe every reporter, television, radio, print, is an investigative reporter. Where it separates a little bit is some of the projects that take considerably more time to do. You know, if I'm looking into what the city council is doing, it may take me an afternoon. But I have worked on investigations for the Herald Leader that took several months to finish. I worked on a series of on some stories in 1989 for about 5 months and published five stories at the end of that that came out of that. So it's partly distinguished by the amount of time and the depth of research that you have to do to get where you're going.
Well, all professional journalists have a set of guidelines to follow, guardrails to stay within, but are there ethical guidelines that are particular to investigative reporting that may not apply to the general work?
Not really. I mean, some of those are very involved in in-depth stories, so there's more opportunity to go deeper into a subject, and that's kind of what distinguishes mm-hmm. it. But I believe, I mean, every story you do, accuracy has to be the first piece that you get right. It has to be right, and you have to spend the time to get it right. It has to be fair, and it has to be independent. You have to go into it, not, you know, there's a newspaper I've seen that its motto is without fear or favor. And that's really what it comes down to. You're not afraid of anybody, but you don't favor anybody. You do what you can to examine all the viewpoints and gather information from a broad spectrum. But the bottom line is to get to the truth of what happened. As I said, accuracy has to be the first watchword. And there are ethical considerations. Everybody has personal feelings. So if your personal feelings as a reporter are such that you can't be honest and accurate and interview somebody who feels diametrically opposed to you, then you can't do that story. You have a conflict of interest. What has distinguished reporters that I've known and what distinguishes professional journalism, I think, from social media, from talk radio, from so many other information sources that are out there, is that commitment to try to seek out all the viewpoints, all the information you need to come to a decision about what's right, what's accurate. On talk radio, for instance, I mean, there's no commitment to be objective and to try to seek out all viewpoints. It's to advance a particular viewpoint in a lot of cases. And that's, I think, what distinguishes professional journalists.
Well, often in the development of an investigative piece, there's a reliance on maybe anonymous sources. We saw that in spades during the Watergate investigations and so forth, and we've seen it ever since. And anonymous sources are critical sometimes to getting that information. But does the use of an anonymous source place some sort of special burden on the reporter?
There's always a burden, as I said, to get it accurate. I mean, sources many times have viewpoints or axes to grind. Somebody, you know, an anonymous source contacts me because they're mad about something that happened at the state agency where they work or the business where they work or wherever that they're giving me information about. So you understand at the outset that the source may be biased. That does not mean that their information is bad. The fact that they have a point of view and an axe to grind doesn't mean they're not right about what they're telling you, but it becomes incumbent on you to confirm that. So yeah, stories can often start with an anonymous source, but you still have the professional and ethical obligation to find out what's really right and what's true and what's accurate.
Well, you've been known to have a very unique eye for what makes Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky in particular special, special place. Do you agree with that assessment? And if you do, what do you think you have brought to the work that has made it stand out in this way?
I'm loath to say that I'm anything special, Tom. I mean, I feel like I've been the luckiest person in the world. This job covering Eastern and Southern Kentucky, getting to roam around and do stories about that area, there's not a job in the world I'd trade that for. I just love doing it. I would have kept doing it till I was 90, but it was time to kind of slow down a little bit. I don't know that I bring anything special to that. I think it benefited me that I grew up in the area. I grew up in Somerset. I grew up in a rural area, so I have maybe some understanding of rural people and the way rural places work that somebody that grew up in Chicago or Philadelphia doesn't have. I mean, I just loved the area, and I was glad to get to do stories about it. I don't know that I have any unique perspective that anybody else from the area wouldn't have had. Though, I mean, you combine that perspective with some professional training, and I think that's where it comes to.
Well, you've done some major series that have changed the course of Kentucky law, affected our way of life. Stories like Cheating Our Children, it was a Pulitzer finalist, and is credited with leading to the Kentucky Education Reform Act, CARA. There was Prescription for Pain, that was an examination of the early opioid epidemic in Eastern Kentucky. Stories like that. So what stands out in your mind, Bill, as a major achievement that you're most proud of?
Well, I'm proud of, I believe that I tried to do the job honorably on big stories and small for a long time and tried to get it right, and I'm proud of that. And I worked hard at it. I mean, it's, you know, it can be a stressful job and it requires long hours. I mean, when there's a tornado or something like that, you're working 50, 60, 70 hour weeks because there's so much going on. But I hope that I did the job acceptably. I'm not, I wouldn't claim that I was great at it. And I said in the final column that I wrote, I felt like I didn't do it justice. I mean, there's so much, it's such a fascinating area in Southern and Eastern Kentucky in particular, that I don't know that I did it justice, but I had a lot of fun doing it. And there were, as you mentioned, I mean, I'm proud of the stories that I think played a role in making the state better. Cheating Our Children, you know, helped lay the groundwork for CARA. The legislature approved $1 billion in new taxes to fund education. And within a few years, you could see Kentucky go and new governance structures, limits on nepotism. It was a broad ranging bill. And within a few years, you could see Kentucky go from, what, 46, 47, 48, the bottom, you know, it was in the bottom five in the country at one time. And you could see it move to 25 halfway through the pack. You know, still, it's not number one, but there was dramatic improvement in the outcomes. And Prescription for Pain, you know, I think we were out front and try, and helping folks understand the depth of the opioid problem in Eastern Kentucky after OxyContin kind of exploded beginning in the late 90s, early 2000s. And Congressman Hal Rogers, who's the representative from Eastern and Southern Kentucky, started Operation Unite as a result of that. And I checked with them the other day. I was working on something else. And since 2005, in the last 20 years, more than 5,000 people have gotten to enter residential drug treatment with money through Unite. So those people got to go to drug treatment because Congressman Rogers responded to the reporting that we did. I did a series of stories on special districts who had a little kingdoms, which was kind of a takeoff on a book Robert Ireland did about the counties in Kentucky being little fiefdoms. But I had never seen, there hadn't been a lot of attention paid to them, to water districts, sewer districts, all those sorts of things that receive and spend a good bit of money and affect people's lives, but nobody had really looked at what they were doing. And we found some problems in the way they were administered. I did a series of stories in 2006 with another reporter from the paper about Kentucky's incentive program, economic incentives, that showed a lot of counties that just had simply accomplished nothing. I remember in Harlan County in particular, there'd been funding for 10, 12 different projects that almost all of them had fallen through. So it kind of raised the issue that, whether that was an effective way to pursue economic development. So, yeah, there have been some projects through the years that I was really proud of that I think made a difference.
Well, something you touched on a little bit earlier, I'd like to explore it just a bit more, and that's today's journalistic landscape. What do you make of it?
Well, I think a lot of people have lost faith, lost confidence in what sort of traditional main or mainstream media, whatever you want to call that, and they get their news from Facebook or they get it from biased sources. And I think it's unhealthy for democracy. It's unhealthy for the country. I wouldn't claim that mainstream media is perfect. It's committed many mistakes. It's contributed to the lack of trust people have derives in part from the mistakes that the media has made. But I really believe one of the major reasons for that is because politicians for many, many years, you mentioned Watergate earlier, Richard Nixon, denigrated the media for trying to tell the truth about him and said, don't believe him. They're a bunch of bums. And of course, it turned out to be true. Politicians for decades have been saying, don't trust the media when the media has done stories about them that they didn't like, when tried to hold them to some account. And so the people who support those politicians, and you see it even into the present administration where Donald Trump talks about the media being the enemy of the people, which is just a lie. I was never the enemy of anyone when I was in the media. But when you have politicians doing that, that erodes trust in the media. And I think that's dangerous for democracy. So I think the media needs to do more to tell its own story as to why it should be trusted, why it's accurate, how it has a system in place of trained people and editors behind them to try to make sure that we get it right and are complete. I think we need to do it. I think the media needs to do a better job telling its story. And I think politicians should back off on denigrating the media when there's a story they don't like and calling it fake news. I mean, that's just garbage. You could look at all those stories that have been described as fake news, and they're not fake. They're, they've gotten at some truth about what's going on.
Well, now here we are with a generation of up-and-coming journalists who know nothing other than a digital landscape and a lot of what we're talking about here. As you're moving on in life, what can you say to them, to the next generation of journalists who are coming into this field under entirely different conditions and circumstances?
Yeah, I think journalism, I think going forward, the other thing I would have mentioned in response to your last question, the other thing that the mainstream media needs to do is find the new ways to deliver the product that we create, the news that we generate. And I think there's a lot of avenues to do that. I mean, I'm actually encouraged by the younger reporters that I worked with that are at the Herald Leader right now. They're starting out at 22, 23, 24. They're better than I was at that age. They're smarter. They're more technologically savvy. And they have tools on the internet and elsewhere to research stories and to tell stories that we didn't have when I started. So I think that's what mainstream media is going to have to do going forward is find, is continue to explore those models to deliver the news. And they're going to have to find some way to generate enough money to do that. I mean, to me, journalism is a unique business because I think it's first and foremost a public trust. It has an obligation to serve the public in a way that General Motors doesn't. General Motors exists to make cars and make profits. To me, the media, journalism, newspapers, their first obligation is to serve the public, but they have to generate enough money to pay the people to do it, to pay the salaries of the people to go out and find the news and curate that, you know, research that and deliver that. So they're going to have to figure out something going, some way to go. And I don't have the answer. There's smarter folks than me. They're going to have to figure out how to keep that business model relevant and retool that going forward to be able to do that. But I would say the bottom line is, you know, the world runs on information. And, you know, we've gone through the industrial age, we're in the information age now, and I see no end to that. So there will, I believe there will be a market for people that know how to find information and develop that and deliver that. So I would say to a young reporter starting out, you may be doing it 5 years from now in a way that I can't even imagine, but there's still going to be a pressing need to do it because democracy runs on informed citizenry. That's a bedrock principle. If people don't know what's going on or don't care, then I think that's really dangerous. They'll leave it to people who will dominate it for other purposes. So there's always, there's a market for that information, and it's critical that we have it. So there'll be jobs for people who can find it and deliver it.
Well, Bill, I can tell you personally, every time that I've picked up a paper, back when I picked up a paper or opened up a web page, if I saw a Bill Estep byline, I read that story. Well, I mean, I can't say that about everybody, but it was every time I saw that that you had done something, it was certainly of interest to me. And I'm sure that that's true for so many of our listeners. And we appreciate your 40 years of service. You did do it justice. And appreciate you taking time for us today.
Well, thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. As I said, I felt like I had the best job in the world. I got to cover a place that I love and meet interesting people, and it was just the best job I could have imagined.
All right, Bill Estep, thank you for joining us on Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Bill Estep just retired after 40 years with the Lexington Herald Leader. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.